You are listening to a presentation of the book Changing Places, written by and read by Myra Yarborough DeBruel. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is being produced in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. This begins Disc 6.
Chapter 39, Nashville. I hesitate writing this story. When I told my friends I was going to write a book and put our school in it, all of them wanted to know, "Did you write about Nashville?" "No," I said. "But you have to," they answered. "It's too personal," I said. "But then nothing else would be believable," they observed. "So one more time, I will reflect on this time once more and empty it out of my soul." The weeks and months passed with young love covering them all. Although days seemed long with lots of time, the summer of Donald's leaving approached quickly. The summer before he would be leaving from Nashville, my parents let him come to the house for a weekend. I took him to meet all my aunts, cousins, and Mama, who lived close by. Mama fed him cherry pie because she thought he needed to be fattened up, and he seemed to love her. I wished I could take him to meet my Granny Kimball. We spent lots of time playing records and trying to get away from Mama and Daddy. Saturday afternoon, we walked down to the creek and sat on the creek bed and talked about our dreams. It seemed to have happened so fast. We lay on the grass and looked up, picturing things in the summer sky. I only saw bridal gowns with white clouds making a long veil, a dark cloud as a brown church, and then I had to laugh as Donald saw an elephant. "That's me when we were having our first baby," I said. I know I thought this was truly the love in my life, and I could never bear being without him. Truth was, I was afraid to be without him. The people at the North Carolina Commission for the Blind, as it was called then, had furnished Donald with clothes and money and promised to support his venture in Nashville. They had no way of knowing that he was planning to marry a little, immature, insecure girl. As Donald left for Nashville, I tried to remember the navy blue suit that the commission representative had furnished for him. He told me that was going to be his wedding suit. I remembered the bride doll he bought me before he left. He said she looked like he knew I would look as a bride, only I would be prettier. I remembered our talks of love and the Now or Never song Elvis sang into our hearts over and over again on the 45 RPM. Somehow, however, all of it was not enough. Sitting on the creek bank and talking about our dreams was comfortable. But when he left my house and then his house for Nashville, my heart went into a panic attack when nobody knew what a panic attack was. When we were left at school at the ages of 6 or 7, there were no counselors or sweet voices to lull us into a tranquil acceptance of our reality. We just stopped crying one day and never knew when or why. But when Donald left for Nashville, I remembered. I remembered those nights when, as a child, Mama and Daddy didn't come back like I thought they would. For weeks, they didn't come back. Then, when we went home, things were all changed. A piece of furniture was moved. The house was new. Uncle or aunt, somebody had died. It was never the same again, and none of us could figure it out. We turned to each other for love and comfort. We would find a friend at school, and then, for some reason, she would leave. Insecurity does not even begin to describe this confused teenager who believed she could never be happy again. For nights after Donald left, I lay awake trying to figure out how to fix this emptiness inside me. Knowing that this was our plan so we could be together later didn't help me at all. Ever since getting hit with a car at age 13, Mama and Daddy would not even let me go to the mailbox by myself anymore. Larry asked them to please let him get me a job or a date. He told them I could work at Jimmy's barbecue stand, filling up trays with French fries or drinks. He was dating a girl named Linda and seemed to be really in love, and told Mama and Daddy that we could double date. I could not imagine double dating with him and his girlfriend, but I surely would like to try. I wondered if this would help my aching heart. I felt alone and nauseous thinking about Donald. Every night I took my little transistor radio, tucked it in bed with me, plugged the earphone in, and found Nashville's station on the radio. I listened to song after song, missing him with every one. Finally, I began wondering about joining him in Nashville. Why didn't we go ahead and get married? What would another few years matter? I lay awake every night planning an escape while the music played in my ear. The first, I had to get Laverne and her friend Jody in on my plans. I decided I needed to get to Greensboro and spend time with Laverne. From there, I could catch a bus to Nashville and find Donald, and we would get married right away. It all sounded so simple. Everything would be wonderful then, wouldn't it? No one would leave me again, and I'd be a wife. It is amazing how easy it was. First, I had to convince Mom and Daddy to let me go to Greensboro, which was the most difficult part of all. I moped around the house, whined, and acted disgusting. Finally, they were ready to get rid of me. Mama thought that maybe it would help my loneliness with Donald gone. She sat in the Queen Anne blue chair with the white flowers across from Daddy's platform rocker that was always where I sat when Daddy was not home. "I only get to be with you in the summertime," she said. "And now you don't even want to stay at home for 2 months. Can't you even give me 2 months?" "I'm only going to be gone for a week," I said. "Just think, after graduation you will be stuck with me for a long time." I am sure she was hurt as she relented, but her hurt was not important to me, only mine. That Friday evening, Daddy took me over to Greensboro after work. On Saturday, Laverne's sister went to work, and I was left with my friends Laverne and Jody, who tried very, very hard to convince me not to run away to Nashville. I had to give them a good reason. I felt cornered. There was no way I could go back to Lexington and live the rest of the summer in such a lonely place. There was a plan I had made before leaving Lexington, in case they would not help me run away. After hesitating a bit, I decided to tell them that I was afraid I was pregnant. I had practiced my story alone in my room so many times, it just came out as convincing as though it was truly real. This was the beginning of the string of lies to follow. It was with tremendous reluctance that they agreed to help me catch a bus to Nashville in the middle of the day while Laverne's sister was at work. I remember standing between them with a ticket in my hands as they begged me not to go. Yet, like the friends they were, they hugged me goodbye. I got on the Greyhound bus and rode right back through Lexington and slid down the seat just in case Laverne had called Mama and Daddy and told on me. She had not. In my little overnight hope chest there was a blue chiffon dress I planned to wear for my wedding. I still remember the beautiful little blue dress. Once I wore it to church on Sunday, walked home to campus alone that day, and a little boy was riding his tricycle on the sidewalk. "Here comes a pretty girl," the 5-year-old said. Just then I almost fell over his tricycle. "Here comes a pretty blind girl," he said. Now, with the little Siobhan in the overhead above me, packed up with my teenage dreams, the bus climbed the Blue Ridge into the Great Smoky Mountains. Darkness fell as the bus turned this way and that, and the darkness covered me as my courage grew faint. Up and up we went, as though I was climbing out of my own skin and was living in another person's. The little blue chiffon dream kept me staying my course. All the movies of young love and all the true stories Anne had ever read to me played in my imagination. I would be the victimized pretty young girl torn away from her lover, determined at any cost to fulfill her greatest dreams. People watching the story would cry at our wedding. The sweetness of it all. Every young girl's fantasy. I had just enough money in my purse to call Donald. That's all I needed, wasn't it? The bus pulled into Nashville on a rainy Sunday morning. I took my little overnight case and went into the bus station. I had to call about 4 numbers to find Donald at the auto mechanic school. I was totally caught off guard to realize that he was not happy. In fact, he was horrified. He told me to stay right where I was, and in about an hour, he walked into the bus station, angry and scared. "What are you doing here?" he asked. "What were you thinking?" He just kept pounding me with question after question, and I realized I had made a terrible assumption. "I want to get married now," I told him. "I don't want to wait until next year. Why can't we get married right now? I love you." "And what would we live on?" he asked. "What if I am not able to do welding like they are concerned about? I can't believe you are here expecting to get married. What in the world is wrong with you? We talked about this for months. You are going to turn right around and go back home." At first, I thought I might faint, or maybe I would just throw up like I used to when I was little. Then the tears started. I couldn't even see Donald's angry face. He took my suitcase and put it in a locker at the bus station, then took my arm and led me outside. He took me to a payphone and tried to make me call home, but I wouldn't. We stood in the phone booth with my tears steaming up the booth on the inside like the rain did outside. I just couldn't stop crying. People knocked on the windows of the booth wanting to help. Donald yelled at me, told me I was nothing but a little girl. He took me back to the bus station and bought me a ticket back to Greensboro, North Carolina. The bus would not leave until late evening. Wondering what to do in a big city on a rainy Sunday, we walked around looking at marquees to see what movies were playing. He then took me to see movies, One-Armed Jack and The Parent Trap. Things were just not happening like I imagined at all. He had quit yelling at me by that time, but we never smiled at each other, never laughed, and waited for the movies and the day to be over. Both of us knew that once my bus left the station, our relationship would end. We stopped in a small cafe, and I tried to eat a burger, but my stomach was already filled up with terror. Then the last movie was over. We walked slowly down the wet Nashville street to the bus station, not talking at all. Donald retrieved my suitcase from the little locker and carried it outside. Once the bus pulled up, he pulled me into his arms and hugged me so tight for a minute I thought he might have changed his mind, but it was just his way of saying goodbye as he kissed me quickly. Then he told me I had to go home and grow up. The sweetness of the goodbye was all gone. There was no tenderness in his voice now, and his face showed no emotion at all. His eyes, which were usually a soft brown, looked dark and almost menacing to my tragic heart. In 1 month, he seemed to have changed into someone I had never known. I tried to accept what he said and somehow began to realize I must look like someone he had never known as well. How could he know me when I didn't even know myself? He stayed long enough to be sure I got back on the bus. I watched him light a cigarette as the bus pulled away and his brown plaid shirt faded into the evening. Going back down that mountain to face the lie I had told and facing Laverne and Jody and then go back to school having lost my boyfriend whom I love was more than I thought I could ever live through. I did not know at that time that when Donald got back to his room, he found out that my parents were looking for me. Evidently, Donald and Daddy had talked, and both their emotions were very raw, and Donald lost his temper. As I watched the evening fade, I had no idea that Daddy knew I was headed home. Rain and more rain fell over the bus, and the wipers made a noise that would have otherwise put me to sleep. We stopped occasionally to pick up a cold, wet passenger. We had driven in the pouring rain for what seemed like hours when the bus was stopped by a policeman. I had just about fallen asleep. The driver told us that the policeman was looking for a runaway. I sat frozen in my seat, trying to put a confident "I'm 18" look on my face. The light came on the bus. The policeman really didn't go through the bus, but just looked at it from the front of the bus and told the driver he was sorry for bothering him. Tried to get comfortable once more. I still wore the lavender skirt and striped blouse I had worn to Nashville, and the chiffon dress was still rolled up in the little overnight case. But my dreams were broken into pieces that fell under the wheels of the bus, grinding them into shreds until there was nothing left. I was sure there was no one to care. Not meaning to, I had put myself right back in that place, that six-year-old place where there was no one to love me and no one to care. Must I live it again and again until I got it right? But that was a question far over my head. I knew no psychology or why I was so insecure, just that I hoped the bus would have a wreck and I would die. Of course, that did not happen. Chapter 40, Lexington. All the way back down the mountain and then into Greensboro, I had no idea that my parents already knew about my trip, and Mama and Larry were planning to meet my bus. It seems that Laverne's sister and her husband had come back from their beach trip, found me gone, and wanted to know where I was. Laverne and Jody tried to convince them that I was just visiting another friend in Greensboro, but Harry, her sister's husband, interrogated both girls until they relented and confessed that I had left. During all this, unknowingly, I sat quietly in my seat on the Greyhound, with rain still pouring on the bus as it rambled back down the Smoky Mountains, giving Ronnie Millsap's Smoky Mountain Rain a whole new reason to be written. After what seemed like years, the bus stopped. I picked up my little overnight suitcase and stepped off the bus, wondering where the pay telephones were. After the last step, I headed toward the bus station door, only to feel a hand on my elbow as Larry said, "Hey." He and Mama were waiting for me. I was horrified. Something seemed to happen to me then. At school, I used to wonder about my personality. At school, I was Myra, happy, singing all the time, having fun with my girlfriends and boyfriends, talking to visitors who came onto campus to visit our school, playing, skating, jumping rope, loving life. At home, I was Susie, who had come withdrawn, shy, introverted, sensitive, and very quiet. Now, someone I didn't even know seemed to take me over. I would not cry and did not even need to pinch my fingers to keep from it. I was angry. Those tears I cried in Nashville that day were the last tears I cried for a very long time. Mama and Larry took me to Laverne's house to pick up my other suitcase. To try to save some dignity, I lied and told Laverne and Jody that I'd gotten married. Then we were going back to Lexington before I could think about what was happening or what to say. I couldn't think about Laverne or Jody just then, but could only wonder how in the world was I going to get out of this mess. Once home, Mama made me sit down in the Queen Anne where she had sat when I convinced her to let me go to Laverne's. She sat on the couch and Larry sat down in the big platform rocker. I looked hard at Mama's face. It was framed by pretty dark brown curls and looked like a mad picture. Larry's hair was very dark, too, like Daddy's, and I wondered why I got the blonde hair when theirs was so dark. I looked at the white flowers in the faded blue chair, but then I realized Mama and Larry were trying to talk to me. Mama said she wanted to slap me. I said, "Do you think that would be the first time I ever got slapped?" I had never told Mama and Daddy about times I had been mistreated at school, and I thought about using them now to disarm her rage. For some reason, I thought of Carolyn, what she said years ago in school about trying to live between home and school took on a real meaning. Suddenly, I wanted to blurt out all the misfortunes that had ever happened to me. I wanted to remind Mama about the time our gym teacher made us creep across the gymnasium floor on our knees with our heels bent and toes pointed up. Our arms were stretched out with our chins almost touching the floor. We were required to stay in that position, pushing hard with our knees until they bled on the shuffleboard numbers that were painted on each side of the gym floor. We did this for over an hour. Laverne, Hazel, and I went to the infirmary with badly cut knees, and the nurse had been furious about it. Yet, I wanted to tell Mama so many things and didn't understand what was going on inside either of us. I wanted to tell her about the time that the gym teacher took us to Pullman Park. We were all excited, and I wanted someone to sit on the seesaw with me and the teacher said she would hold the seesaw and ride me. At first I had laughed, but then the board started going up and down in a fury, faster and faster, until my bottom could not keep up. It bumped and bumped until finally I lost my balance and fell onto the ground, knocking the breath out of me. The teacher laughed and asked who else wanted to ride the bucking bronco. For days, Sally found splinters on the insides of my legs and took them out, but we never told. Didn't Mama realize something horrible had to be going on inside me to cause me to take such drastic measures to change things? Didn't anybody wonder why? They just thought it was being in love that caused everything. "You are my very life," Mama said. "Well, I never should have been," I said. "That was not fair to anybody, especially to Larry." "You made our daddy cry," Larry said as he jumped into the conversation. "I made daddy cry one time, and I never intend to do anything to hurt daddy like that again. But your running away was about the worst thing you could do to him." No matter what Larry said, I knew he came closer to understanding me than anybody else would. After all, he was in love himself, and last summer, Linda's mama had taken her to Whiteville for the summer to try to break them up. "Daddy went back to work when he found out you were all right," Mama's voice interrupted my philosophical thoughts. "But he plans to beat you when he gets home." There were times when I saw Daddy spank Larry with the fly swat and even his belt once, but Daddy had never spanked me. This made me stop sassing Mama and just sit there glaring at both of them as though they were the monsters they seemed to think I was. Mama kept fussing at me until she either got too tired or just ran out of mean words. I realized that no one at home even knew me. How could they? I did not know how to communicate my inner feelings with them. And all the beautiful clothes Mom had made me, and the especially nice record players, typewriters, and Braille watches Daddy bought me. The word love was never mentioned in our house. I thought about the hard-headed doll with the cloth body Mama had handed me on the first day of school long ago. Even though I knew the doll was her way of saying that she loved me, at night as I cried into the doll's soft body, it seemed as though something was missing. Now I sat almost numb inside, still not knowing what was missing. Finally, Mama got up to go start supper, and Larry went to feed the dogs. Everything would go on as usual. I got up and went out on the front porch and sat on the swing. Donald was gone. My parents, as I had known them, seemed to be gone. Surely I must be the one who was wrong. I thought about Laverne and Jody and how I would ever get them to understand what I had done. I didn't even understand myself. How could they? I watched the cars going up and down the road and thought about all the colors they made in the middle of this dull day. The sunshine had returned, hot and bright. The corn hid Mamaw's house from my view, and its tall stalks still seemed to be waving at me. I began to put myself in a place away from the day and join in nature's beauty. I walked around the house and saw the red tomatoes shining in the sun. I picked a small one, wiped it on my shirt, pulled out the stalk, peeled it back just a little with my teeth, and sucked out the sweet juices as I ate it. At least that was the same. I picked up the dipper and turned on the pump, filling it with well water. It was cool and fresh. I sat down in the grass and looked up the skies. There were no bride's veils and no churches, just little white bunnies and blue dolphins, and then I was sure I saw an elephant. I walked out in the corn and let its stalks hide me from everybody, but I knew Mama was keeping an eye on me, no matter where I went. I shucked an ear of corn and pulled off its silky silver threads and tasted it right off the cob. Nobody would ever do such a thing, I thought. But the fresh kernels of corn tasted good as they popped in my mouth and got hung up in my teeth. Bugs flew and crawled around in the field, and the dirt under my feet was uneven. I loved the clods of dirt. I wanted to just lie down and become part of the garden. Maybe something good would grow inside my heart. But I walked on back to the front porch swing and waited for Daddy's truck to come down the road. When I saw his green Chevy coming, I ran into the bathroom and washed my face and hands and took off my shoes. Then I sat down at the supper table and waited. Daddy passed my chair and pinched my neck like he always did. "Hey, Pump," he said. I was surprised when I felt the tears in the backs of my eyes and realized I really could still feel something, even love for this man whose heart I had broken. My shy home demeanor took over, and I would not cry. Instead, I said everything was fine. "Did you know we were looking for you?" he asked. "No," I answered. "Good," he said. "I'm glad you didn't know. I'm glad you didn't worry." "She should have worried," Mama almost yelled. "She just went and did whatever she wanted to and could care less about anybody but herself. It would not have hurt her to worry. Aren't you going to beat her?" "No," Daddy said. "She has been through enough." "What?" Mama exclaimed. "Leave her alone," Daddy said. "What did you find to do in Nashville?" "We saw two movies," I said, and told him the names. "Do you want me to tell you what they were about?" "No," he said, "because I plan to go see both of them this week. Do you want to go see them again?" "Yes," I answered, because they were both really good, especially The Parent Trap. The next morning, I wrote Jody and Laverne and told them about the stories I had made up to convince them to help me. I'm sure they did not know just what to believe. That is something I just had to live with. But I knew, and Donald knew, and I am sure Daddy knew. And to me, that was all that mattered. Much later, I started to wondering about the bus stopping for a runaway. I thought about the fact that the men did not just walk through the bus, but took a look and got off again. Now I truly believed that Daddy had told the policeman not to get me off the bus, but just to make sure that I was on it. Had the policeman taken me off the bus, I would definitely have been horrified. That would be Daddy's style, speaking to me from his heart without words ever being needed. Somehow I did hear the word love. With that knowledge so firm in my mind, somehow my broken heart began to heal. I shucked form with Daddy when he had time in the evenings, and I rode with him to see the corn and the hay that he and Larry were going to be harvesting soon. Even though I told Jody and Laverne how sorry I was, I just couldn't say the words to Mama and Daddy. I am sure, however, Daddy knew I was. In everything that happened, it did surprise me that nobody thought to ask me why. What would I have said if they had asked me? I didn't know. I just knew I was looking for something or someone to hold on to. Someone who would say the word love. Someone who would not leave. Chapter 41, Raleigh. When school started, my trip to Nashville was headlined in the campus gossip. My best friend at that time, Jackie, didn't care. I heard that Donald had left Nashville and gone to public school. I decided at that point just to enjoy myself. It was on a hayride when, wearing Chuck Langley's jacket, as we sang songs and stole a few fall kisses in the moonlight, that I decided to never love desperately again, but enjoy my junior and senior years. Some of the girls just couldn't understand. It seemed to them that I paid no price for my adventure, received no punishment, and still had lots of boyfriends and enjoyed every minute of every day. However, I paid an inward price for my adventure. Eventually, Donald returned to the school, and after a while had passed, we began dating once more. However, I was never again to love him in that careless, unconditional way. Still, we thought things would get better, and surely we would be married one day. So, what does this have to do with blindness? Nothing, really. Except to say that blind people are truly just people. We do dumb stuff, and sometimes we do smart stuff. We laugh and cry and fight and love just like everybody. We are born with personalities that develop into the same type people we may have been if we would not have been blind. Who is to say but God? How do we use what we come with to make the best for ourselves and those around us, and develop around us the environments we find ourselves in as children? I believe that as adults, we can finally learn who we are and shed the skins of youth and grow into the places we want to be. Maybe never fully getting there, but striving for, not utopia somewhere else, but joy in our own lives. The summer of that year lasted well on into the fall. One day, near the 1st of November, I went to Jackie and said, "Before it gets too cold, let's go ask Miss Winstead if we can go to Pullen Park. We'll tell her we're going to sell ads for the yearbook." "Mrs. Winstead is too good to us," Jackie said. "She's the best house mother we ever had. I can't lie to her." "Okay, we'll tell her the truth. Miss Winstead, we're going over to Pullen Park," I said. "Pullen Park is not a place we were normally allowed to go by ourselves." "Okay," Miss Winstead said. "If anybody asks, I'll tell them you have gone to sell ads for the yearbook." Jackie and I pumped our swings until we were as high as we could get without going over the top bar. "Still Miss Tommy?" I asked her as we passed each other in the air. Her "I don't know" followed her lips to my ears and to both our hearts. Next pass, Jackie asked, "And do you really love Donald?" My "I don't know" passed between us, encircling the path our swings made. An echoed truth like droplets of love between best friends. She never asked me why I still dated him if I wasn't really sure, because she knew. I just didn't know. As we all stepped on the same acorns, played in the same fall leaves, listened to the same music, and read books, the tears inside a young heart melted tender into that nowhere place, perhaps to be cried later. But Jackie and I learned to have fun. It's really hard to think about crying when you are doing the hula hoop, dancing the twist, and teaching the younger children how to jump two ropes at the same time. Chapter 42, Interjection. It was the very early 60s. Things were changing. Girls began to get to know boys and their families, even some of their dreams. The family of the North Carolina School for the Blind grew. There were only a little over 200 students, but that was a large number for the students from kindergarten through 12th grade for the school. I remember a time when I didn't think the school could survive after Carolyn and that class of senior girls graduated. Not only had all those girls looked like princesses when they went to their prom, but they wore different gowns when they had a senior recital, as they were all talented young ladies. A debutante anywhere could not hold a candle to their performances, their grace and dignity. I also sang high soprano then, sometimes hitting the high notes for Carolyn, just like I had for Billy in second grade. But where Carolyn was poised, well-spoken, and perfect, I was all over the place, flirting with the boys and begging Miss Davis to let me sing a Connie Francis song. It never happened, the Connie Francis song, I mean. Those girls graduated in 1960, and still things went on at the little school that sat on the crest of a hill. Ronnie Millsap was more popular than ever with his rock band called the Apparitions. Jay Spell was the keyboardist. Larry Atwell played bass. Chuck Langley played the drums. Ronnie played guitar, and Ralph Thompson was their manager. Ronnie had a personality that went far out the gates of our little school. He was doing more to promote blindness to society than probably any of the rest of us ever will. We all loved his band, but he did not often get to play on campus, as rock music was not permitted. It seemed that almost every weekend he was playing somewhere off campus in Raleigh for a dance or some musical event. I secretly always wanted to sing with his band, but it was unheard of, a girl singing with the boys, so I kept that little secret inside. However, I did still sing with Billy, and his voice was strong now. He didn't need me anymore, but no matter who we dated, Billy and I were bonded friends for life. Whispers of integrating the school littered down to our ears. The black students went to a school on Garner Road with their own principal and their own rules. None of us could imagine mixing the schools and paid little attention to the talk that was going around. Sometimes we wondered if we were prejudiced or not. We loved our maids and our cooks, but never even thought about asking them to do anything with us. Of course, they couldn't have anyway. In Fisher, our maid was named Georgia, and we named our old wringer washing machine after her because it worked as hard as she did. I recall once when Laverne and I were in the bathroom together, I was taking a shower while she was just walking around talking to me. As she made circles walking around our wringer washer, she patted its round tub, saying, "Georgie, Georgie, Georgie." Both of us were surprised when our maid, Georgia, answered, "What?" Still, to think about actually rooming and living with a black student felt very foreign to us. We all talked about how we loved to hear them sing, but would we live with them? I think Mom probably looked in the newspaper every day expecting to find my name in it, as I was not one bit bothered to eat beside or sit beside anyone who was black. But while we were just being blind and getting prepared to get dumped out onto society, school picnics and high school kept us too busy to get involved in anything else. Everybody had a story. Rumor has it that William Driver had come to the school because his father had aimed a gun at someone, and William jumped in between the bullet trying to stop the fight. William did stop the fight, taking the shot in his eyes. Totally blinded and fortunate to be alive. His dad was in prison. William's personality was gentle, and one wondered how a dad like that had a wonderful boy like William. There was a girl named Sandra Judy Atkins from Greensboro. She was blind because her stepmother had punched her eyes as punishment until the sight was gone. There was a trial, and the stepmother was found guilty of punching her eyes until Sandra became blind. For all the demons we fought sometimes as blind children, I am sure Sandra's were probably the worst. I will not say she never recovered, as she raised two children with a totally blind husband. Don't ask me to write how. But Sandra is the shake-a-leg girl who could make us laugh, cry, or throw things. Yet I find myself realizing how even though we all loved each other as only children can, we failed each other in many ways. Someone would lose a relative or a friend, and the rest of us seemed never to know what to do. I think of how I should have rejoiced with Anne over her new sight and returning to a life outside the walls of our little school. So many passed along the path of childhood with unspoken words, for we had not yet grown into the meaning of it all. Now, while we're at school, we did not permit each other or anybody to call it a blind school, as I just did. Once we learned what adjectives were, we realized that to call it a blind school was insinuating that the school itself was blind. This began to be our chat from time to time until someone suggested that the school name be changed. All the students from grades 6, I think, through 12 were allowed to vote on a name. Of course, since John Motley Moorhead had founded the school back in 1845, it was suggested that we call it the Governor Moorhead School. We also did not like the NC School for the Blind being written on our school bus as we traveled here and there on our field trips throughout the state. We went to the General Assembly, and a few of the seniors spoke about why we wanted the name changed. Little did we realize that through the years, somehow, it would end up getting called the Governor Moorhead School for the Blind. While we lived there, the days and years seemed to ebb and flow smoothly until we didn't realize they were almost gone. Ronnie Millsap's class graduated a year before me. It was a great class. Miss Gilmore, our French, world history, American history, and economics teacher called Ronnie a Greek god. People are surprised when I tell them that Ronnie was not the superstar in school that he is today. His music was not permitted very much in the practice rooms, and even though we knew he was extra talented, no one of us had any idea of how far he would go in his world of music. However, he was a strong leader in high school, the student government, and even once, he headed up a homework strike. We didn't do our homework until Mr. Stow threatened to give us all F's and call our parents. Ronnie didn't mean to start a homework strike. He just mentioned something about it one day, and we all jumped on the strike wagon. If Ronnie said it, it must be the cool thing to do. Chapter 43, Junior Year, A Time to Dance. It was decided that every Wednesday night, girls and boys would eat in the same dining room. This meant that Donald and I could go off campus 2 evenings a week for supper and stay on campus for supper on Wednesday nights. Occasionally, the apparitions would play, and we would dance after our supper for a little while before we all had to go back to our rooms to study. I had heard that the apparitions were going to play the following Wednesday night and was looking forward to it. On Monday, after leaving the Nickelnack, I was late for my piano lesson. I knew that Mrs. Ashcraft would not fuss at me, but I was in a hurry and darted quickly into the basement door. I knew I could run across the hall, up the stairs, and get there more quickly. I was totally unaware that Donald had gone into the wrestling room, which I had to pass on my way to the upstairs door on the other side. As I ran, Donald stepped out of the wrestling room door, grabbed me, and twirled me around for a quick kiss. Then, almost without even stopping, I was on my way again, right into Mrs. Yelverton, as she came out of that door I was going into. She was a school librarian. What in this world she was doing there, I had no idea. The only place I had ever seen her was in the library, the teacher's cafeteria, or in the principal's office on Monday morning, complaining about how badly we had behaved and acted in church. I knew I was dead in the water. No Wednesday night dancing for me. She didn't speak as she held the door for me, but I knew her next stop would be Dr. Harley's office. Sure enough, the next afternoon, Dr. Harley called me into his office. Dr. Harley was a young man who had been our principal for 2 years now. He had gotten his Ph.D., and we called him the good doctor. Every now and then, his wife would call Jackie or me to go down to their house to babysit for their baby son. We all loved the young couple. Several times, Dr. Harley had spoken to me about going in the wrong doors. Maybe he would let me off this time, too. No such luck. Dr. Harley took my privileges away for a week. Fortunately, Mrs. Yelverton had not seen the twirling kiss, just me being in the wrong place. This meant Donald was not campus, only me. Wednesday night came, and I could still eat with Donald, but no dancing. After eating, the apparitions began to play. The music was sensational. People started dancing. Donald wouldn't dance since I couldn't, so we stood off to the side. I could not keep from tapping my foot, having to control myself to keep still. Dr. Harley had evidently come over for dinner because he was there. I don't know why he took pity on me, but he came across the floor and said, "Goodness, girl, go ahead and dance." I suddenly released this burst of energy I had been holding inside. It felt like we were on American Bandstand. Ronnie's band had won awards, and it was hard to believe he was not a professional. Donald and I danced to every song they played. The music took me over as my spirits seemed to claim every note for my own. It seemed as natural as this is what we did every day for years. The cool fall atmosphere, the flowers, the smell of cologne, but mostly the music lifted my spirits so high I felt like I was flying, not dancing at all. Too soon it was time to study. I picked up my books and went into room number 7, as I liked to study in there. It was difficult to get my mind back on studying. The night had been so special to me. As I sat there with my hand on the Braille American History pages, I heard voices coming from Mrs. Winstead's room next door. Her room was on the other side of the bathroom like a hotel suite. The door to room number 7 was always locked, but evidently the door to Mrs. Winstead's room was open. I was shocked as I realized my friends were talking about me. They talked about how I had danced with the beautiful white quilted satin skirt with silver threads that were full and swirled above my knees when I danced. "She never gets in trouble for anything," one said. "She and Jackie just think they are perfect little angels," another said. "But she is willing to tutor us in all of our lessons and never complains," a classmate said, but then finished with, "But she is a show-off with the long hair and the tight dresses above her knees." "Yes, and don't dare to speak to her boyfriend," one of the senior girls said. "She thinks she owns any boy on this campus." I knew each girl who had spoken. If the bathroom door on room number 7 side had been unlocked, surely I would have walked right into the middle of them. I did think about going around to knock on Miss Winstead's other door and join them, but actually I was too shocked to go there. Mrs. Winstead's answers were too soft for me to hear. It was just a few minutes later when I heard her door close and the sound of footsteps walking down the hall. I began to wonder who ever said that being a teenager was the best time in life. I was getting tired of it. When I was sure that my friends had all gone, I went to Mrs. Winstead's room. I felt disappointed that she had allowed other girls to talk about me that way. "What was all that about?" I asked her. "What in this world have I done wrong? Were you just going to let them talk about me and never tell me? Didn't you hear what I said?" she asked. "Besides, were you just standing at the door listening?" "I was studying in room 7, I told her. "Did not mean to be eavesdropping, but it's hard to stop once you know the subject is about something you did. Didn't you hear what I said?" she asked again. "You were not mad and didn't talk loud enough for me to hear," I answered. She took my hand and set me down in the chair across from her bed as she sat down. Her spread was red, not pink like ours were. There were daisies on the spread with the yellow middles that seemed to smile up at us. Immediately, I expected another lecture about going with Donald. "They are really your friends in spite of tonight," she said. "They were not mad, just jealous. I realize you do try to help them study, and they don't seem to appreciate it. I told them all that you are friends and that one day all of you would look back and remember the friendships. All friends disagree at times, but they were just upset that you were the best dancer on the floor tonight and were having the great time they wished they were having. That is all that little session was about, and I did take your part. I plan to drop the Beta Club next week because they tell me that it's for snobs," I said. "It's just hard to know what to do, and somehow I must make some of them feel bad instead of helping. Maybe I just don't know how to help anybody." "You just have entirely too much fun," she said. "Don't you dare drop the Beta Club." She stood up and hugged me and advised me not to confront my friends. But maybe it would help if I would just try to compliment them more when we study or when we do things together. I left her room and went back to room number 5, thinking about the evening. It was just a night that I had a good time, and that should not have offended anybody. I thought about the music. Did the music in itself offend those who were not a part of it? Did it offend those who were not singers? Everybody had a chance to develop their skills. Cooking and sewing were taught in home economics, and every year an award was given for the best in each. Geraldine Stallings usually received that award. There was a track and field competition in gym, though it was mostly for the younger children. A new cheerleader squad had begun for our wrestling team. Jody Bolton was captain and led the team into fun and traveling with the wrestlers. Piano tuning was also taught. Even though girls didn't want to tune pianos, lots of the boys did, and often went off campus to tune pianos in the schools and churches for which they were paid. Chair caning was also taught. Mostly boys did this too. However, Stella Hall was so good at it, she was allowed to bring her cane to Fisher, where she would cane chairs for hours. She also received money and recognition for doing it. There was a mattress shop on campus where boys could work after school, and some even through the summer, making mattresses for all our beds, as well as for contracts from other places. Some of the technically skilled boys started a campus radio station. The teachers were quite impressed with the skills of Danny Hampton, the founder, Ronnie Millsap, and a few others. The teachers, however, were not impressed when they realized that the boys were playing music late at night for the girls who were listening. There was a school orchestra as well. At times, all the instruments were packed up on the school bus, and students and teachers rode to visit places in North Carolina to play for Lions clubs or schools in the area. I thought about all these opportunities and decided that Miss Winstead was right. Even the white skirt the girls had mentioned was beautiful and full. Of course it swirled above my knees when I was dancing. It was already above my knees even before I started dancing, as all the styles were short and all of us wore them. My hair was long, but others also wore their hair long. Yes, I would forget about it, although I did drop out of the Beta Club. The year was almost half over. I sat in the window of room number 5 and looked out into the darkness every night, waiting for the campus Christmas tree to be turned on. In years past, a few times I had told Laverne the lights had come on before they really did, just because I loved how happy it seemed to make her. Then she was so disappointed when she found out it hadn't happened. I stopped doing that. Jackie, Aileen Luck, and Shelby Jean Hastings were roommates this year. I brought a little green artificial tree from Lexington with a light on top. We put gifts for our boyfriends around the little tree, and the light and colored paper seemed to scream Christmas. It seemed to me that Aileen could see as well as Anne and Sally had been able to. She wrote names on all the gifts and cards that we bought. Every morning, either Aileen or Jody Bolton would help me be sure my lipstick was not smeared. Some mornings, Aileen would even iron something I wanted to wear to school, and I didn't have time to do it. Sometimes she would do it even if I did have time, just because I begged her to. It was a good room. It was a good year. Miss Davis was true to her statement not to take students on as many trips anymore. She did begin to be fascinated with Ronnie and his apparitions. Ronnie had asked her often to help him with voice, and now she seemed to want to have a say in his future. I did feel a distancing of my relationship with her, but I was enjoying piano and my teacher, Mrs. Ashcraft, and playing for Jay Spell to play the violin in the Christmas program. Some of us begged Mrs. Winstead to let us walk to the Raleigh Christmas Parade. It was always at night then, and it was so beautiful. I don't remember how many of us there were running down Hillsborough Street that night. We wanted to get past St. Mary's Street, where the first bands were. I was running when I tripped on the curve and fell. I got up and kept on running. We all enjoyed the parade, the majorettes, and the dancing. How I loved the dancers and the whirling batons. It was not until I got back to campus that I realized my ankle was swollen so big I could hardly get my shoe off. I put it in the hot water and figured by morning it would be well. The next morning, I stood on the ankle, started down the hall to take my bath when I passed out with the pain. Donald and Wayne were called over to take me to the infirmary. I was taken to the doctor, but he said the ankle was just sprained and didn't need an x-ray. It was several years later when I sprained the ankle again at Duke. The orthopedist there who took x-rays asked me how long it had been since I had broken my ankle. I remembered the incident and always had wondered why that ankle turned over so easily. For days I had hobbled on crutches. But since I thought the ankle was just sprained, I tried to ignore the pain and just kept on dancing. Finally, spring had come. For weeks, we worked on our junior-senior prom. We decided on a Hawaiian theme and spent hours making leis of colorful flowers. "What difference do all these colors make?" Donald asked. "Most people can't even see them." "But some of us can, and we can tell the others about them," Wayne said. "Besides, it gets us out of economics and English." Steve Smith found a large roll of blue poster board, and we used it to represent the ocean, tacking it to the wall of the YMCA, where the prom was to be held. Jerry Garner, who lived in Moorhead City, brought shells from the ocean, and we used them as table decorations and glued some of them to the light tan poster board that represented the sand of the Hawaiian beach. We hung leis from the ceiling and hung them together in colorful chains. The rule was that all senior boys had to have dates before the juniors could pick out anyone who was left. I was sure everyone knew that Donald and I would go together. So I was surprised when Donald set me up to go with one of his roommates, Mac Kennedy. Mac was a nice boy, totally blind, who had come to school after being in a terrible car accident when he was almost killed. We all loved to hear him talk about the accident and the positive ways it had affected his life. However, I was not happy that Donald had arranged for my junior prom date. "So who are you going with?" I asked Donald. "I'm not going," he said. "I think the whole thing is ridiculous, but I know you want to go, so just have a good time with Mac." I wanted to yell at him. He knew I would not have chosen this particular date, but he probably also knew Billy and I were waiting, hoping to go together if everybody else was dated up. Billy didn't have a girlfriend just then, and as it turned out, he went with June Roberts, a pretty girl with wavy black hair and a smile that could light up Raleigh. June was totally blind, but seemed to understand things beyond her years. Finally, the night came. I wore a strapless blue gown Granny Kimball had bought for me. It had tiers of lace and frills, and Mac gave me a colorful corsage to match the Hawaiian theme. Hazel Foster, Stella Hall, and Jody were some of the other girls who were there. We sat across the table from Billy and June, neither of them thinking it was funny when I asked Billy if he remembered the parsley in second grade during that trip we had taken in our young lives so many years ago. "It still tastes like it came from my grandfather's pastor," I said. Billy and I spent a lot of the evening dancing together. All those years between us created feelings around our hearts we didn't realize might happen. "Are you going to write me when you are in Durham taking medical transcription?" he asked. "I mean, do you think we will even see each other again once school ends?" "Oh, Billy, we still have a year left here, and you will be over at NC State. We won't need to write," I answered. Then suddenly it felt like the years were falling away without him. "Oh, goodness," I told him, "you are the most stable person in my life. Of course we will always write or call or even see each other. Even if Don and I get married." "I don't think so," he said. It felt like a veil had fallen over our heart. "Will you go outdoors for a few minutes?" he asked. I nodded. We danced out of vision of the chaperones until we found a door leading outside. Cars went up and down Hillsborough Street as we walked over to the Velvet Cloak Inn next door and found a quiet place under the trees next to the parking area. Honeysuckles flavored the air around us. Colored lights peeped through the leaves, but we didn't care. Suddenly, we felt like we were back in Miss Davis's room, holding on to each other. His hair was thick and blonde. I ran my fingers through it, touching it quickly and firmly to make sure I would always remember. His eyes and my dress shone like a blue mist in the velvet cloak lights. He didn't have a girlfriend just then, but I forgot all about Donald. Billy's hands touched my bare shoulders and moved down my back. I stepped closer, and as our lips tasted each other's, we hugged each other so tight we could hardly breathe. Our passion was almost full-blown until a car horn blew loud and the brakes squealed out on Hillsborough Street, bringing us back to reality. "What are we doing?" I asked, breathless from the kisses. He tried to pull me back to him, but the moment was gone. He put both his hands on my face and looked close into my eyes, our lips grazing each other with his words. "Why won't you come back to me?" he asked in a soulful voice. "I don't know," I said. "I know you love me," he said. "I love you tonight, but you know I love Donald, too." "You're afraid of him, aren't you?" he asked me. I pulled back as thoughts of Donald crowded in. I hadn't thought about it. Maybe I was. All I knew was that I was comfortable with my life just then and definitely did not want any more trauma. I took his hands from my face and turned back toward the Y. "This is wrong. Let's get back to the Y before somebody besides June and Mac start missing us." I felt bad about what I had done. However, just before opening the door to the Y, his blue eyes glanced into mine and I kissed him quickly, because it just had to be. No matter about the people or chaperones or even if all the lights in America were shining on our faces, it was if somehow I knew it was our moment. Never again would be in this particular time in our lives. Never again would we be 17. Never again.
You are listening to a presentation of the book Changing Places, written by and read by Myra Yarborough DeBruel. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is being produced in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. This ends Disc 6.